You're listening to First Point Japan's Spotlight Series, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins. And now, here's your host, James Santagata.
Today, Ken Charles joins us again from Apex KK, which is a Tokyo-based executive search and recruiting firm, where he runs the technology practice. Ken's specialty is recruiting primarily, not only in technology, but startups and gaming, among other things. And for today's episode, we've asked Ken to take us on a deep dive of the gaming industry. Hello, Ken. How are you doing?
Doing good. Thank you.
Great. So today, we had a good response in the last episode we had with you talking about a little bit higher view of tech recruiting, startups, and gaming in the Japan market. And today we thought it would be a good idea to maybe take a little deeper dive, a little closer look at maybe the dynamics, challenges, and opportunities of the gaming industry in Japan.
Great. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it.
Great. Okay, well, maybe to start, we could maybe start looking. I was thinking it would be interesting if we could look at maybe the domestic game market. So maybe looking, I don't know, maybe go back 10 years. I know that's quite far in this kind of fast-paced industry, but maybe with traditional consoles through mobile, could you talk a little bit about what changes we've had, maybe from console to PC to mobile, and some of these older or legacy players like Sony, Sega, Nintendo versus DNA, Gree, or Gung Ho, or whoever in the domestic market?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, talking about the Japanese domestic market, you know, so the console market isn't necessarily what it used to be, right? And it's, you know, it's a lot harder to, you know, sell your console to people. So the numbers aren't quite there. The games, just by nature of, you know, what people's expectations are and where graphics have gone. I mean, the budget for creating a top-selling game is increased dramatically. So it's become a very difficult market in a lot of ways. So, you know, what we found, obviously, over the last 10 years especially, whether or not you're there today, I mean, the ultimate evolution of all these companies is they're going to have to be a mobile company, a mobile game shop at some way or another. And that's just market forces at play. I mean, you've got, you know, I just saw a stat, actually. I was misquoted the last time, actually. I didn't have the number in front of me. There are now 1.8 billion smartphones in the world. And that's a install base that consoles have never, ever touched. So a lot of the even games, you know, companies like Sony or, like, say, Square Enix, for example, who've had great success in the past with console games, they've been moving more of their top-tier IP to make things for mobile. You had the rise of some companies that created gaming platforms for feature phones. I'm talking specifically about, you know, Gree or DNA, which is the Mobagate platform, and it's that was kind of really the big leap forward for mobile gaming when those companies started seeing the success that they were having. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, overnight, mobile gaming turns into a multi-billion-dollar industry. And this was before the rise of the smartphones, but before the iPhone was ever even released. Mm-hmm. So those guys, I mean, the Grees and DNAs of the world, I mean, they had a tremendous run and they made an awful lot of money. The issue that they ran into was they were gearing up for their global growth right around the time when Apple was and Google were about to begin their dominance of the smartphone market. Mm. So you had a situation where Gree and DNA were doubling and tripling and quadrupling down on expanding their platform internationally into the U.S., buying companies in America and other countries, setting up headquarters and all over the world, right when their market was going to be, you know, carved out from underneath them by this new native game, smartphone game world. Mm-hmm. So now it's kind of like, I mean, the power of the distribution of a game, if you can get it into the top of, the App Store or in Google Play, is just, I mean, it is shocking. The most amazing story. I mean, yeah, people hear about Puzzles and Dragons and, you know, Candy Crush and a lot of these mega hits. But the most amazing story recently that I've been just kind of infatuated by is this game called Monster Strike.
Okay.
Have you heard of Monster Strike?
No, I have not. Okay. No. Can you tell us a little bit about
that?
So
Monster Strike is actually it's a really fun game. I can describe it as like a combination of like an RPG and pinball, basically.
Okay.
So, but the thing is, it's a huge hit in Japan. It's making tons of money. They have TV advertisements everywhere for it. But the most interesting thing about it was that this game was released by a company which you probably remember called Mixi.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, Mixi, for those who may or may not know, Mixi was the dominant social network in Japan before Facebook. So these guys were kind of like the MySpace, the dominant player. They were the MySpace of Japan. And then just by, I mean, going up against Facebook at the height of their growth period was an impossible task for almost any company. So I don't fault Mixi for kind of, you know, their business stagnating and their growth stagnating, but they lost a lot of market share to Facebook. And they were relegated to being kind of a, like I said, kind of a MySpace-esque company where, well, they had a good run, but, you know, it's kind of, they're still around, but nothing that is, you know, that exciting is coming from them. Until last fall, something came together. They released Monster Strike as a game because they're trying to release games because they want to get back into relevancy into the market. They struck gold, and Monster Strike is a huge hit. And now they've reinvented their company. Now they're basically a mobile game company, and their market cap, if you look at their stock price, they're now substantially larger than DNA, substantially larger than Free. They're larger than Cyber Agent. This the power of one successful game on a native smartphone release can literally transform an entire business overnight. Wow. That's the change that's happened with mobile. So the domestic market is just filled with older incumbents who are reinventing themselves and trying to develop a native strategy, a successful native strategy, and new startups that are maybe 2, 3, 4 years old who are just all in chase of that big hit. I mean, if you get that one, you know, if you get that one big hit, you can create a $1 billion industry or $1 billion company overnight. That's
right.
What's happening in the domestic market. So it's basically like the Wild West right now.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, now maybe coming off of this, what about for foreign game companies? And just to be clear, when we're saying domestic, we're talking Japanese, and foreign would be the people coming from outside of Japan. That's our point of reference. But for the foreign game companies, or we'd say the Gaishke, I don't know, EA, Zynga, whoever, what is their philosophy for market entry or in getting a business established or trying to accelerate it here in Japan?
Yeah.
Did you see any trends or anything? You don't have to name any names, but just generally speaking.
No, absolutely. I mean, I work with quite a few foreign game companies as they put together their market entry strategy for Japan, for hiring their country manager to, you know, building the kind of advertising and marketing strategy. It typically starts with, you know, so you have a game, it's doing well in other territories. Maybe you've noticed organic success in the Japanese market. Maybe you've actually made a localized version and it's doing well in the market, relatively speaking. So you want to accelerate that process, right? So the question then becomes, well, how do you want to do it? Do you just want to hire a country manager who can then manage, say, on-the-ground marketing and advertising? There's some companies that do that, where they come here, they hire somebody maybe out of an advertising agency or, you know, with a strong marketing background for games, and then ramp up the ad spend in Japan, figure out the model for online, offline, TV, billboard, you name it, and see if you can have your game reach lots and lots of people. Hopefully it's a success and you make lots of money. That's right. One strategy. So it's a perfectly viable strategy. It's kind of the lesser aggressive way of you know, going after the market. The other side are companies that actually have said, hey, you know what, this Japanese market is not only lucrative, but it's also unique, and we should actually double down and start building a small Japanese game studio in Tokyo. And there's a handful of companies who have actually been doing that, starting to build their teams here, take advantage of some of the local talent, say, hey, Japan, the gaming industry in Japan is filled with brilliant game developers, brilliant game designers. Why don't we create games, use our background and our resources, but create games for the Japanese market? And they'll hire somebody who's basically becomes the studio head for Japan. Typically, they'll be managing both local original development as well as the localization process for the games that the company is producing for other territories. That's a more aggressive way of going after the market, but potentially it's a much more lucrative way of doing it.
So, sure.
Yep.
Okay. No. Excellent. And what do we see? Maybe I guess a couple things. Okay. Actually, let's continue on this thread and maybe talk about what about domestic Japanese firms in these areas that now decide to go international? You touched on, I think, some of the timing issues that Gree and I think it was DNA faced when they were going overseas. What do we see now that kind of smartphone boom is kind of I don't know if it's peaked yet, but it's at least in the developed countries is probably pretty saturated. Is there more opportunity for them to go overseas again, or what's happening with the domestics?
Yeah, so everybody, of course, look, they want to expand outside Japan. I mean, Japan is an island nation, and there's only so many smartphones, so many people, right? So of course you want to be bigger. What we're seeing, there's a lot of people who were, you know, kind of brought in by the allure of international expansion outside Japan. They maybe bought into the dream of what, you know, Gree was trying to accomplish or what DNA was accomplishing. And maybe they saw that, hey, things didn't work out so well for what they were trying to do. And what it's done is it's led to an entire kind of rethinking of the international expansion for the Japanese market. Now, I network and meet lots of entrepreneurs and lots of executives in the gaming space in Japan. And what I'm seeing a trend is, okay, we want to learn from their mistakes, and we're going to go about it in a different way. So sometimes that means, okay, we're not going to try to conquer the West. You know, we're not going to say we're going to make games that are going to succeed in the Japanese market and in the American market. However, we're going to focus very heavily on releasing games for the rest of the Asian market. So, you know, we can make games that we can tweak a little bit, and they could be a hit in Korea, a hit in Taiwan, a hit in Indonesia, a hit in other areas, and we can own the Asian market. And let's do that before we think about trying to go for the rest of the world. Okay. So I'm seeing that as one big trend that's occurring now. The other one is companies are getting a bit more savvy with their Western international expansion. So there are some companies I work with, they've established small headquarters in America and in Europe, and they're starting to get involved with things like M&A activity or with small investments. So they're setting up small investment funds to then seed and make partnerships with up-and-coming smaller developers over, let's say, in the U.S. and California and other areas to say, hey, let's, you know, bring our resources, our money, our name, our connections. Let's empower some on-the-ground talent in some of these, you know, these foreign territories, and let's let them kind of guide us and lead us to success in those markets.
Interesting.
That's another thing that's happening with some of the smart companies that are going about it that way. It's basically, so that's, you know, those are two trends that I'm seeing, which are very different from the, you know, kind of the previous winner-take-all world domination approach, which is high risk, high reward. And unfortunately, it led to, like, you know, thousands of people in America and other countries and in Japan losing their jobs. I think why people don't want to do that again. See that happen?
No, it makes sense. Okay, well, maybe now getting into a little bit of the human side. You know, we hear about these memes and such, like, you know, the war for talent and such. How do you see this playing out? Maybe if I, maybe looking at some of these game companies, whether they're domestic or foreign, you know, maybe we're looking at things like designers, I don't know if they're, you know, producers or game directors, the actual, you know, programmers, et cetera, DevOps. What's happening in terms of recruiting and talent acquisition, talent retention on the ground, I guess?
So, yeah, I mean, it's wild. The only closest thing I've seen outside Japan to the talent war is what's going on in Silicon Valley for engineers with, you know, Apple and Twitter and Facebook all fighting over the same pool of people, you know? But what's happening here is, if you're a good game designer or, you know, good game director or producer or an engineer, you probably have a great job already at one of the game companies. The game companies, they know how hard it is and how difficult it is to recruit talent. So they're doing everything in their power to keep you in the company. So there's really no reason for you to be actively job seeking at all. Couple that with the fact that you've got, culturally speaking, Japanese people, although engineering is a little bit different, but culturally speaking, Japanese people, you know, tend to not change jobs. They have much more loyalty towards their companies than you see in the West. And then couple that with the fact that they're technical people, especially engineers. Engineers want to work on cool things and solve cool problems, and kind of they're not as necessarily sometimes as money driven or as career, you know, driven as you might see with, say, you know, salespeople or, you know, cutthroat business people, that kind of thing. So you have this inertia where people are in their job and there's no reason for them to actively be seeking jobs. So you cannot, like, you know, trying to recruit for engineers here, you can't throw up a job listing on LinkedIn and expect great people to apply for it, because there's no reason for these people to be on LinkedIn in the first place looking at jobs. They've got a good situation as it is. So from the, like, the recruiting standpoint, they have their pick of companies that they can work at. They've probably already picked one, and there's no reason for them to think outside of it. I have this one, actually, great game director who I'm working with, and he's just put in his resignation at his company, and he's got his pick of wherever he wants to go next. And I sent him a list of 15 different game companies that we work with, and I said, where do you want us to introduce you? And he picks one company. He says, all these other ones are kind of, you know, in my mind, they're not so great, so I want to go to this one. And you know what? He's probably going to get a job there.
Right.
Like, so that's the reality of the situation. So from a recruiting standpoint, it's the way we do it and the way that we have to do it is we're constantly networking. We're fielding referrals. We're building a reputation in the market with game professionals that, hey, you know, we're one of the good guys. We actually know the market and we know what you're looking for. And it's just constant, nonstop networking. It's every single week we're meeting as many game professionals as we possibly can, because today might not be the right day, but we want to make sure that, hey, at least they know what's out there, what their options are. We can provide them with a little bit of career guidance for why they might want to consider a different type of company. Right. And then when the time is right, they'll be willing to make that move.
Here's one other one, too, I'd mention, not to speak ill of any company, but I've heard, you know, from the business side, say, you know, a line manager or top management or HR says, well, I don't really see much difference, say, for gaming of the candidates I get doing it on LinkedIn versus the recruiters I've used. And then when I've kind of asked which recruiters, they're often some of the larger international ones. Why do some of those seem to have a problem having, connections or ability to generate some of these gaming candidates?
It's honestly, it's commitment and focus to the market. It's, you know, it's being able to speak the language. I mean, I don't want to knock any, you know, of the recruiters. There's a lot of good recruiters in Tokyo, but if a guy was teaching English 6 months ago and now he got a job in one of these big recruiting firms, he's not necessarily going to know how to network or where to network or be able to establish the kind of the quick rapport with the candidates that says, hey, I actually know your industry and I live and breathe it just like you and I'm here to help you. So what happens is they're not able to kind of get access to that entire, you know, world of talent that other people can't. I mean, it's, you have to know, okay, who are the players, who are the companies, who's doing what in the industry right now, which companies use which type of, you know, tech stack, for example. So, like, you know, it's, you know, okay, well, if he's a Ruby on Rails programmer, not to send him to a company that's built on a LAMP stack that doesn't touch Ruby on Rails.
Right.
If I went to him and I showed him a job description for a company that's built on, you know, on LAMP, and he's a Rails programmer, he's going to immediately categorize me in with the, you know, kind of the rest of the recruiters that don't get what he does for a living. Mm.
Right. No, makes sense. Yeah. So basically, you know, there's a wide variety I won't say competency, but maybe focus, specialties. So even if they've had perhaps not as good results with one of the firms, or maybe ones that are more focused or specialized as well. And I guess the other thing is also, sometimes though, the expectations are too high for the Japan market because there's so few candidates anyways, if you're looking for bilingual talent.
Yeah.
You know, to be fair, you even if it was the same international firm recruiting in the US or England, you might get 5, 10, 15 candidates, whereas here you might get one, right?
Yeah.
Just because there's such a dearth of talent and such a high demand. So that also may be a mismatch of expectations as well.
There's plenty of that, I mean, unfortunately, but that's our job as a, you know, as professionals in the market, is to guide the companies and let them know the reality of the talent pool that they're in. I mean, I have those tough conversations a lot with managers where it's, hey, listen, these are the best three people on the market that are available. And it's like, you have to, I know it might not fit every single criteria you would hope for, especially with an overseas hiring manager. I said, but you know, this is the reality.
And
sure enough, I mean, it's you have to develop that level of trust where the companies will listen to you. That's a big part of our job as well. And that's what we try to do. I mean, we charge a lot of money for our services. We're not, you know, recruiting in Japan is not a inexpensive service. Mm. And we want to make sure that we provide as much value as humanly possible when we, you know, for the, you know, for the companies we work with.
Yeah, I think you're right about that trust, because you're coming in, someone's coming in with a different paradigm and expectation, and here's the top three. And then, of course, you know, we know from being here how fast those three people may go.
Yeah.
That by the time they're waiting, suddenly they say, oh, well, I'm going to bite the bullet and pick one of the three. And now we're down to only one of the three or none of the three, because they all got snatched up in the last 4 weeks when they were debating it. And yet it's hard to believe that until you've kind of been in the market. I know it's a little bit of a flip side, actually, for a lot of the foreign guys looking for jobs here is, you know, they might come in and they find an opportunity and you say, look, this may be the only thing available for you right now.
Yeah.
It's very hard to believe. And then suddenly I'm going to look around and they look around, there's nothing. And then they're, you know, searching for 6 months or 8 months. It's so there's a lot of different expectations, I think, to the market realities here.
Absolutely.
As well. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it takes time and experience to get to know that and understand it. I mean, reality. Yeah. And I mean, that's why I enjoy my job, and I enjoy, you know, being able to, you know, understand all those little nuances about the market.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. One last thing before we close, then. Is there anything you want to mention or perhaps share? Do you see any trends, or what do you see for the future, maybe over the next 3 or 5 years, which is actually quite a long time in the way technology is moving?
Well,
within mobile gaming or gaming in generally speaking.
Well, I mean, the market has spoken, right? And you've got a lot of companies that do free-to-play social games, and then they monetize via micropayments and, you know, things like that. There are some new companies that are doing some really cool things around advertising and promotions around the gaming space. So, like, you know, companies where people can, you know, you can have branded content and branded rewards for passing certain levels and things like that. And there's been a bit of a resurgence in from some sectors and some areas for premium paid games as well. So from what I'm seeing with a lot of the startups and a lot of the, you know, the businesses being done, there's going to be, people are sick of the traditional kind of, they call it gacha model monetization, which is basically, it's no different than playing a slot machine. That's the traditional Japanese monetization model for mobile games.
Right.
So there's going to be a lot of new energy and kind of innovation happening around how the gaming companies, how the games themselves make money. So that's going to be a very interesting trend to look forward to over the next few years, is who is going to come up with the new models and the new ideas. Because gacha is proven and it's great, but speaking on the ground, the people are getting very sick of it. And
okay, I see. Yeah. Interesting. Great. Okay, Ken. Well, I think that's it. Anything else you'd like to add then before we go?
No, I mean, just the only thing is, like I said, we're happy to reach out and talk to anybody who's interested in the gaming industry or tech or startup industry in Japan. So my contact information should be up on the screen, I think. But
it'll be up there again. Absolutely.
Yeah. So just look me up. It's Ken Charles at Apex KK in Tokyo. I really enjoy these podcasts.
No, very informative. Great. So today we've had again Ken Charles from Apax KK, a Tokyo-based executive search firm. And today we did a deep dive into the gaming industry, both domestically here in Japan as well as for foreign companies coming into Japan and for Japanese domestics looking to expand internationally. Okay, Ken, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. This program has been a presentation of First Point Japan, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins.